Joining us now is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and previously was Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be here.
And your institute was behind a report that just came out that was featured in on a front page story in Monday's New York Times, "The Middle Class is Steadily Eroding, Just Ask the Business World." And I must say it's a very disturbing trend and not totally surprising. But it looks as if in the business world, where we know that big chain stores like Sears and JCPenney are in trouble. We learn, of course, that on the other end, Barney's is now taking over from Lohmann's, which is going bankrupt, etc. So do we have a plutonomy now instead of an economy?
Well, it's what Willie Sutton used to say. Why do you rob a bank? Well, that's where the money is. And I think for our society, it's somewhat unfortunate. But the very high concentrations of income and wealth, particularly in the aftermath of the crisis of 2008, have led to a concentration of earning power and spending power in a very small segment of the population. It's serving places like New York and San Francisco and catering to the tastes of what you might call luxury goods, luxury automobiles, luxury clothing, luxury restaurants, and that standard middle class baseline that Sears or JCPenney represented is part of what's being hollowed out.
I have always understood that the U.S. economy is something like 70% driven by consumer spending. And you may recall, Robert Johnson, that after 9/11, the first thing that President George W. Bush said was tell everybody to go to the mall. So it sounds like if only the rich are buying, the economy is not sustainable.
Well, I think there's real serious questions there. The wealthy people, as you know, have a much higher amount of savings. And so they can shut off or turn on their consumption rather capriciously, whereas the middle class is much more, purchasing staples, things they need for their livelihood, food and basic clothing and so forth. So it's a much more dependable form of demand, whereas for the wealthy, it's like I said, switch it on, switch it off. It's luxury. And that makes for a much bumpier road for the overall macroeconomy. Unless business investment steps up and is very resilient and strong. And in the aftermath of 2008, business investment has been very cautious and very reluctant. Lots of big corporations are hoarding cash.
So the new study that your Institute for New Economic Thinking funded, specifically done by the economist Stephen Fazari of the Washington University in St. Louis and Barry Sineman, of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, finds that the top 5% of earners accounted for almost 40% of personal consumption expenditures in 2012, up from 27% in 1992. Now, I recall a few years ago there was a leaked memo from Citigroup by one of its analysts that talked about the idea that we could get by with the plutonomy, with only the rich purchasing. And at the time, it was greeted with a lot of alarm, but it's looking more and more like it's actually coming into play.
Well, I would say there are two dimensions of alarm. One is the nature of a society where people's access to, which you might call influence in politics or lifestyle, is so markedly different that they almost cease to be members of the same society. The other dimension, which Sineman and Fazari talk about, is the resilience of the economy. The economy itself becomes much more volatile, much more turbulent, much more unstable when you concentrate wealth, as has happened in this country. I think both are sources of concern, but the problem in an economy where there is a very broad population that's not even in the middle class is they tend to experience lots of credit rationing, And in recessions, they shut off their consumption much more violently because they essentially have to hoard cash for fear of being laid off. And it makes the downturns much steeper and the upturns much more what you might call delayed and fragile. And I think the American economy is suffering from these kind of problems based on this analysis.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, who's the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee. And the you just mentioned one of the authors of this new study that your institute financed, Mr. Fazari. He said that it's going to be hard to maintain strong economic growth with such a large proportion of the population falling behind. And I recall a talk that was once given that I was hosting at the UCLA Hammer Forum with one of the sort of he's called a patriotic billionaire. he was saying, Nick Hanauer, he did a TED talk that got a lot of attention, and he was basically making the point. He said, look, I'm a rich guy, but I can only go out to a fancy restaurant every now and then. Frankly, I don't like it. I can only buy one or two or three cars for my family. I can't buy 300 cars. And that's always stuck with me, and particularly now when you learn that across the country, the Olive Gardens and the Red Lobster restaurants are having trouble, whereas the Capitol Grill is at the high end, is flourishing. Barney's is doing incredibly well. Lohman's is going out of business. And as we mentioned earlier, the Sears and JCPenney are really in trouble. So address that, if you will.
Well, I think this is a reflection of the structure, this pattern of distribution of wealth. I think that the patriotic millionaire was right in that there's just only so much you can eat. There's only so much you can do. The Capitol Grill, I understand, has a average bill of about $71. Olive Garden's at about $15. Similarly, we're seeing things like JCPenney's going down, Sears going down, but Dollar Store, way at the bottom, the Dollar Store is doing better. At the same time as Barney's and other luxury chains are doing better. And this is a reflection of that hollowing out of the middle class, like the New York Times talks about in their article today.
Yeah, and of course, at the other end of the food chain, if you will, McDonald's is doing well too. So it further reinforces that point. But isn't maybe this is mythology that we're a middle class country? I mean, it always made sense. Henry Ford once say that you have to pay your workers enough to buy your product?
Yes, and in a national closed economy, at some level, that's true. And part of what's happened in the United States is our leaders, like Henry Ford, like the Rockefeller family and others after the Second World War, invested in the deepening and a broadening of the middle class. It became an ethic for society. In more modern times, what Samuel P. Huntington called Davos Man now has his plants all over the world, and he doesn't need an educated American workforce. He doesn't need a healthy American workforce, and he may not even need American demand because the middle class is rising in parts of Asia and parts of Latin America, as well as continuing in Europe. So the Davos Man, as a social leader, is making a lot of money putting his plants in places where environmental conditions and labor working rights have been diminished and where his profit margins are thereby enhanced. And it's a very, very different structure of society than the one that Henry Ford talked about.
Well, interesting enough, though, Robert Johnson, on the eve of the most recent Davos meeting in Switzerland, Oxfam came out with a report that finds that only 85 individuals on this planet have the combined wealth equal to that of half of the world's population of 3.5 billion human beings. I mean, if that doesn't tell us that inequality has taken over, I don't know what does.
Well, I remember that Davos result, and that's quite startling. It is interesting to me that the rapid increase in inequality in the United States has actually been going on since about 1978, and it was not until the Occupy Wall Street movement took hold with their slogan, "We are the 99%, meaning they are the 1%, which I think was coined from a Joe Stiglitz article in Vanity Fair, because he talked about for a buy-in of the 1%, and that's where they picked up their slogan. But that notion of the 1% has been growing for 30 years, and now all of a sudden it's startling. And what's really daunting is the political economy of reducing the influence of wealth when wealth is so concentrated. It's very, very difficult. It's very hard to get congressmen and senators to vote, to make themselves more responsive to voters and less responsive to those plutocrats that inhabit the 1%.
And largely finance our elections, right?
And almost dominate the financing of elections. According to work like my colleague at the Roosevelt Institute, Thomas Ferguson, this is a very, very narrowly constructed, despite the conversations about all of the retail website, it's the unrestricted money, the big post-Citizens United money that dominates who gets nominated, who gets elected, and what kind of legislation and policy proposals are undertaken. And they're often policy proposals quite contrary to public opinion polls as evidence of the wishes of majority of Americans.
Well, it would seem that one of the indicators of the new reality was it came out during the election campaign when Mitt Romney was caught on tape talking about the 47%, which I believe a lot of wealthy plutocrats, and I think he's a sort of minor plutocrat, Romney, or an aspiring plutocrat, I guess, not quite a billionaire, but that I believe is really the accidental truth of where we're at, isn't it? Where the powerful and the rich and the corporate power basically own the government, and they don't really want it to work for anybody else because it's working so well for them. And they've been able to convince an awful lot of people that government doesn't work. And the reason government doesn't work is it's not working for most of us.
Yeah, it's become unrepresentative. An engineer always looks for what he calls a feedback mechanism. When things get out of balance, the feedback mechanism sends a signal and the system corrects itself. And our feedback mechanisms are broken. They're anesthetized by very large concentrated amounts of money. Now, I don't want to be too dark on this in the sense that I know a number of people who are quite wealthy, well within the 1%, who are actually very well-meaning people in trying to inspire constructive change. So I don't think it is as good a system as we would have if representation and responsiveness of politics was much more broad-based. But not all the wealthy people in our country are trying to just put the hammer to the rest of us.
Well, that's true. And Warren Buffett once warned that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy. But these statistics that your institute have studied, that your institute financed, that have now appeared on the front pages of Monday's New York Times, which are pretty alarming, and which is why we're having this conversation, this is a part of something that's out there in the zeitgeist. You mentioned the Occupy movement.
Yes.
So where do we move from now, given that we're heading into a new kind of feudalism? Many have said this is the new Gilded Age. First of all, it would seem that if you use the analogy of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing you have to do is admit that you're an addict. And in this case, admit that we're all victims of a class war that we've lost. So is that the starting point?
Well, in large concept, there is the notion of $1, one vote, which approximates the condition we have. And there's the notion of one person, one vote, which means the democratic currency is stronger. And I do think we're in a period not unlike the very beginning of the 20th century, when McClure's magazine started to publish the works of Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens and others that became muckrakers, and the great movement for social change began first, I guess, under Teddy Roosevelt, and then eventually we moved to Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal following the Depression, and the pendulum swung in favor of a much more progressive and egalitarian structure of society. I think we're hopefully near the starting gates of that, where, like you say, we've diagnosed the problem, and now people have to exercise their democratic currency, meaning their votes, their participation, their activism on a much broader scale, because there are municipal pensions, the quality of their school systems, everything is under threat right now. And it's a very important time for Americans to, what you might call, contribute to the kind of country they'd like their children to have.
Well, of course, the difference is, though, that in the days of Ida Tarbell and Mark Twain and the muckrakers, these tended to be smaller independent publications, albeit with a lot of readership. They didn't have to compete with television and radio. But nowadays, we have this juggernaut called corporate media, and we have open sort of, you know, propaganda operations like Fox News, and it's I guess it's equivalent on the left MSNBC. So we don't have much traction in terms of, well, first of all, we don't have any Ida Tarbells, as far as I know, or Mark Twain's. I wish we did. I'm not sure they'd get printed today, would they?
Yeah, well, I guess that big capital-intensive concentrated media, particularly the television, I think you're right about. But we do have something called the Internet that didn't exist in those days. Mm-hmm. And there may be people, you know, whether it's Cornel West or Paul Street or Naomi Klein, there are lots of very interesting people who are shedding light on many of these dimensions and unhealthy or oppressive dimensions of our society. And the question is, what do we do when we know this? What do we do when we learn these things? How do we exercise the power of community to rebalance society? So, yes, I think you're not going to see an ad for Buy Nothing Day and Adbusters at the Super Bowl. They're not going to put that on. But the Internet is full, as the people at Adbusters have shown us with their websites and their pamphlets on changing economics and so forth, that there's a great deal of potential for people to connect and communicate and propagate things through social networking.
Well, Robert Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who's Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committees. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how the war on drugs is doing on the heroin front.